Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Nuts and Bolts. The Bodhisattva Vow.
From there, it moves into the beneficial effects. And there are a couple of things I wanted to point out. I mean, most of this is very straightforward. And you have the list on the bottom of page 168, entering the Mahayana becomes the basis for all the Bodhisattva training, all evil deeds will be uprooted. Unsurpassable enlightenment becomes rooted. One will obtain limitless merits. All the Buddhas will be pleased. One becomes useful to all sentient beings, and one quickly attains perfect enlightenment. You remember that we talked about karma as the process of evolution, of how actions that we do initiate a process in us that involves into a way of experiencing things. And the actions in that are the genesis of those future experiences. And what I was putting the emphasis on was that it isn't the cause and effect that we're used to in the West, where this action causes that result. It's that this action initiates a process which grows into this experience. What's being described here in these benefits is the process of evolution which the Bodhisattva vow sets in motion. So when it talks about entering the Mahayana, if you go back right to the very beginning, it means of this book, in which he talks about the five types. There's the cutoff type and the uncertain type, and then the Mahayana type, and so forth. By giving rise to this intention and really taking it to heart, you change the genesis of all your life, really, of where your life is coming from. So it's a very, very significant thing. That's what it means to enter the Mahayana. You've become the Mahayana type, as it were. And so the whole basis of your life has changed. And then it becomes the basis for all the Bodhisattva training. Now I want you to think here of something which is growing. So first, the seed has been planted. That's changing the type. And now it starts to grow into various forms of discipline. It would be meditation and the practice of generosity and the six perfections, which we'll be getting to over the next few weeks. And you notice what has been, as they say, uprooted. In this environment, where can negative action grow? Well, there's no basis for it. So even negative thoughts can't take root in this intention to help others. Now, interestingly enough, I found that to be the case. Several years ago, I mean, a long time ago, there's a situation arose for me, which I won't go into details. But it very, very definitely involved a choice between something that was very, very appealing to me and yet something which in some way I knew wasn't right. But it wasn't, something sensed me that it wasn't right, but I didn't, it was hard to construct a really hard argument why it wasn't right. And I kept mulling over this over a period of about a month. And then one day it just dawned on me that what the Bodhisattva vow is saying is you don't indulge your own confusion. And then the situation just evaporated because I could see that what was preventing me from seeing what was actually wrong about this was an aspect of my own confusion. But I found it a very interesting experience because it's exactly what is being described in point C here. All evil deeds will be uprooted because the Bodhisattva vow has always meant a great deal to me. It's what I keep coming back to. And there is no way my own confusion could take root and start growing into something in that context, if you see what I mean. So it's a place to come back to and find clarity in your life. And that's how it uproots evil deeds. It's a place to come back to and find clarity. Naturally, unsurpassable enlightenment becomes rooted. When you plant a seed in a suitable environment, it starts to put down roots, it starts to grow. So it's appealing very, very directly to this metaphor of evolution. And one will obtain limitless merits. It's like a tree growing and it puts forth flowers and all kinds of good fruit. All the Buddhas will be pleased, which one could read metaphorically as those parts of you that want to be awakened are probably heaving a sigh of relief. Oh, finally, he's got on board. No, because there are parts of us that want to be awakened present. We can interpret those as Buddhas. One becomes useful to all sentient beings, definitely, and one quickly attains perfect enlightenment. I'm not sure about the quickly part there, but we'll let that stand. And then if you go over to page 170, you see the beneficial effects of cultivating action bodhicitta, or this when bodhicitta, or this awakening mind, moves to the level of will, then things, your practice has acquired a certain momentum then, and now it starts just to run. That's what's being referred to as one's own benefit arises continuously. Because when your life is about waking up in order to help others, then everything you do is working towards that. So you eat in order to nourish your body so that you can deepen your practice and be available to help others. You sleep in order to be able to rest your body and your mind so that you are able to practice and are available to help others. So absolutely everything you do, even the most ordinary aspects of life, now become expressions of that intention. That's what makes this so very, very strong. Benefit for others arises in various ways. If you drop down to the bottom of the page, this is from Shantideva's Bodhicharavatara. You naturally find ways or see ways to help others in the course of living and interacting with them. And Ram Dass wrote a little book many years ago called, I think it was called, How Can I Help? And it's a nice exploration of what is actual help. And we have the old saying in English, you know, you give a man a fish and you give them a meal, you teach a man to fish, and you give them away, give them a life. Through our practice, we begin to see that what is truly of benefit, helpful to people, and what is of temporary or temporary benefit to people. And more we our interactions with others are aimed at eliciting and nurturing what is truly beneficial to people. So in one sense, it looks like we do less and less, but in another sense, we do more and more. Because that work is much subtler. And it comes very, very much out of our own understanding of what it means to be free. So one may actually let a person struggle with their practice a bit more than trying to make them feel good, because one sees that through struggling with the practice, they're going to learn things at a level that simply making them feel good wouldn't instill in them, if you see what I mean. If you're in a teaching role, that actually becomes a very interesting source of tension. When do I step in, and when do I let them work it out for themselves? Too much working out for themselves, and if you depend on that too much, then often people just get stuck. But if you're always doing things for them, they never really, they don't learn at the same level of depth.
This question is from Dwayne in Washington. I was reading about the pitfalls of spiritual longings in your book, Wake Up to Your Life, and this question came to mind. What differentiates the bodhisattva vow, however innumerable sentient beings are, I vow to save them, from a spiritual longing for universal selfhood, wherein you want to be the most caring, most embracing, and most understanding? On the one hand, you warn of over-the-top idealizations, while on the other hand, this highly regarded vow seems quite ambitious, longing, and an ideal as well.
Okay. The bodhisattva vow that you quote here, I believe, comes from the Zen tradition, the four great aspirations or the four great vows, however innumerable sentient beings are, about to save them, innumerable reactive emotions are, I vow to vanquish them, and so forth. And you're asking, what differentiates that from a spiritual longing for being the most caring, most embracing, most understanding, etc.? Well, this may sound paradoxical, but the only way you can really save all beings is by not being anyone. And if you want to be the most caring, most embracing, most understanding, you have an identity, or you have an image of who you're going to be, and that is going to get in your way. I think you know this. I think we know this in our own experience, because the times when we are most helpful, and most responsive, most understanding of people, is when we have no sense of self, that we are just a response to the pain, suffering, or circumstances that are arising. So the vow, however innumerable sentient beings are, I vow to save them, that's a vow of aspiration. That you, it's setting an intention which is really about opening to the totality of experience, positive and negative, just everything that arises. Where a spiritual longing for universal selfhood is wanting to be something, somebody. And we could go a little further, actually, in the Diamond Sutra and the Lankavatara Sutra and others. There's this wonderful question. Why do bodhisattvas have infinite compassion and want to save all sentient beings? And the answer, Buddha, is because there are no sentient beings. Now, that may seem completely mind-boggling, but as long as we have the idea that there is something separate from us, we are not completely present in experience. And that's what's being pointed to by that paradoxical reply.
This question is from Santina in Prospect Park, New Jersey. I've struggled with the Bodhisattva vow to save all beings ever since I encountered the Dharma. Many times I've read references about how Buddhas can only point the way out of suffering and how each being is responsible for his own way out by making the effort himself. A Tibetan nun once admitted to me that, no, the Buddha did not save all beings before his final nirvana. It's the attitude or the feeling of wanting to do so out of compassion that's most important. Also, I find the Mahayana criticism of Theravada or Hinayana to be unfair. From the many things I've read and discussed with others, if you become an arhat, you would feel compassion towards beings, and there are quite a few teachers in the insight tradition, for example, who are actively devoting themselves to teaching the Dharma for the benefit of all beings. My question is, in the end, what's the difference between being an arhat or a bodhisattva with regard to how one can benefit beings? And if one takes the bodhisattva vow to save all beings, knowing that it's not possible since beings are numberless, isn't that overambitious or just plain unrealistic? Then, if you don't actually save them all, aren't you failing in your vow?
Well, let's take your questions one by one. Your first question, what's the difference between being an arhat or a bodhisattva with regard to how one can benefit beings? I'm afraid I'm really not qualified to answer because I don't know the Theravadin conception of arhat well enough. I agree with you that the Mahayana criticism of the Hinayana is unfair. I don't equate the Hinayana and the Theravada. The Hinayana was a straw dog made up by the Mahayanists to make themselves look good. It's not clear that there was any actual school which corresponded to the Hinayana. I have, because one of my friends and colleagues is a Theravadin teacher, discovered that they also made up a version of the Mahayanists as a straw dog, which they could criticize, because I made a comment once, and he said, oh, you as Mahayana essentialists. And this is the nature of traditions, is that in order to make some of their own points clearer, they emphasize, they will make up a foe, an enemy, someone who doesn't, to provide a contrast. And it's totally unfair, you're quite right. So, getting back to your question about arhats and bodhisattvas, I'm not going to be able to give you anything really substantial on that one, I'm afraid. Second part, if one takes the bodhisattva vow to save all beings, knowing that it's not possible since beings are numberless, isn't that overambitious or just plain unrealistic? Well, of course. I think part of the difficulty here may do with the difference between literal and poetic or mythic language. Mahayana scriptures, and particularly in reference to the Bodhisattva vow, make great use of mythic language, which is a way of pointing to that which cannot be described in words. But the language is, you use this mythic language to at least point to that. So what's being pointed to here when we say, I vow to save all beings? I mean, after all, we have in the Zen tradition, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. Reactive emotions are infinite, I vow to release them all. I mean, this is very elaborate, a very high level, ambitious motivation. And the point is that it is emotionally very, very powerful. You are saying, forming this intention to open to the totality of experience, and which is very, very much a Mahayana theme. There is no limit to experience. You're going to open to the totality, no matter how large, how big, how deep, etc., or how difficult. There's tremendous power in forming that intention and letting one's and the power comes from the emotional tone of just that kind of intending to open to that extent, and that emotional energy then becomes available to fuel one's practice and actually deepen one's attention and deepens one's experience. And this is how such sentiments are used in the Mahayana, and they're used very, very frequently. For instance, in the Mahayana, you have the 1,000 Buddhas of this age, each one of them giving rise to an intention to help all beings. Their own personal bodhisattva vow. And it is said of the last Buddha of this eon, the 1,000th Buddha, that his bodhisattva vow is to help as many, do as much for sentient beings as all of the previous 999 Buddhas have done. This is just so big. And when we embrace the world with that kind of really big mind, quite literally anything becomes possible. But I do want to stress this is mythic language. There's, you know, it's literally true. No, of course not. How would that be possible? But there is such joy and power in the words that it really produces a wonderful power and joy in our practice. So, turning to the last part of your thing, then if you don't actually save them all, aren't you failing in your vow? The vow is a vow of intention. It's not a vow of literal action. And you use this very we use this very high-flown poetic language to give voice to the very powerful sentiments and aspirations that motivate this vow. And as long as you maintain that intention, then there is no sense of failing the vow. After all, from the Mahayana time frame, we have all the time in the universe to do this. So there isn't a point at which we start working. For instance, in the Great Path of Awakening, Jam Kondral says in his introduction to the mind training teachings, even when you attain Buddhahood, there is nothing to do except to work for the welfare of all beings to the best of your ability. That's what Buddhas do. And so he says, well, so you might as well get started now, because this is what you're going to end up doing. And that's why compassion is so important. So be careful about trying to interpret all of this stuff literally. This is poetic language, mythic language, through which we can voice very, very deep and powerful aspirations and intentions, which in turn really do change the way we approach our life and the world.
This question was submitted by Janet in Northern California. I've been contemplating the Bodhisattva vow. How do you know when you're actually prepared to undertake such a vast commitment? When you're aware of your limited capacity to actually be awake and therefore be of service, does that mean that the Bodhisattva vow is inappropriate? Can sincerely taking the vow help you develop awakening mind?
In the Zen tradition, the Bodhisattva vow takes the form of the four great vows. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Emotional reactions are without limit. I vow to release them all. The doors to the Dharma are infinite. I vow to enter them all. The great way is supreme. I vow to master it completely. So it's worse than the vast commitment. It's a completely unattainable or unrealizable commitment. We should be careful in the West because we tend to take things very literally. This is the both the strength and the weakness of modernism. The Bodhisattva vow is an expression of intention expressed in mythic, poetic language because it moves our hearts and it opens us to the possibility of living and working in order to help all beings become free of suffering. So for the second part of your question, everybody who takes the Bodhisattva vow feels they have limited capacity. So the feeling of limited capacity doesn't make it inappropriate. It's a way of stepping out of the story that we have, is that I can only do so much. We aspire to do everything. And so there's tremendous power in that. We find the same sentiment expressed in poetry sometimes. I'm thinking of Browning, man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? And in the third part of your question, can sincerely taking the vow help you develop awakening mind? Absolutely. It's really the intention of the vow By making this vow, it actually it plants awakening mind in you, and now you have a seed which you cultivate through your practice. So it's a very wonderful tradition, the Bodhisattva vow. It's a vow of intention. It's and by performing that intention and nurturing that intention, then you find that there's many things that you thought were impossible actually come about.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.